This podcast episode is an adapted version of a video we uploaded to YouTube. Please enjoy. We've all heard the story of Bonnie and Clyde, the often exaggerated tale of two bank-robbing lovers turned killers who went on the run and were mercilessly gunned down by the police. The romantic side of the tale has been so glamorized in films and books that some do not even realize the story is true. Here we'll look at the real story of Bonnie and Clyde, that reveals that far from being a loved-up couple, they were in fact cold-blooded, callous murderers who stopped at nothing to evade the law and pursue the finer things in life they believed they deserved. Here is the life and death of Bonnie and Clyde. Early life. Clyde Chestnut Barrow was the fifth of seven children born to Henry and Cumie Barrow, and one of four sons. He was born on March the 24th, 1910, although this is often incorrectly reported as 1909. At the time of his birth, the family lived in the tiny hamlet of Tellico in Ellis County, Texas. Clyde was brought up in a hard-working, extremely poor, God-fearing family, and his mother in particular was a strict disciplinarian. Clyde was known in the family as Bud, and was rarely addressed by his real name while growing up. Life was tough for the family. The children slept on pallets in their three-bedroom shack, and happiness was thin on the ground. Their lives revolved around work and chores, and early photographs of the Barrow family show them with joyless expressions on their faces. But they were a close family, and in between working, Cumie did her best to make sure her children attended school and church, and they were expected to live their lives by the Bible, just as she did. She also ingrained into her children that poor people were good and rich people were bad. She regularly beat her children to ensure they stayed on the right path. However, despite her stern approach to discipline, she loved her children and they loved her, and as a family, they were devoted to each other. As they grew older, it was Clyde's older brother Ivan, or Buck as he was known, who started to stray, and no amount of beating and preaching from his mother would stop him skipping school and missing church. This early undermining of his mother's strict regime had a big influence on Clyde, and although he was still safely under his mother's control, he started to hero worship his older brother, and eventually started to show signs of following in Buck's footsteps. An early indication of Clyde's personality starting to manifest when he played with his siblings. He always had to be in charge, and often ordered his brothers and sisters to join in playing various outlaws and gang members. Clyde's particular favourite was Billy the Kid and Jesse James, and from an early age he mimicked these notorious outlaws in pretend gunfights using sticks as weapons. When Clyde reached his teens, the sticks were swapped for rifles, as was typical with country families like the Barrows, who used them for hunting and putting down their livestock. Clyde was also becoming short-tempered and would retaliate at the slightest thing, often ending up in fights with local children and sometimes completely losing control. Nevertheless, despite the scraps he got into, he still shared a special bond with his mother, cemented by their love of dance and music, and Clyde soon taught himself to play the old family guitar and had dreams of forming a band with his friends. But despite the financial struggles within the family, there was nothing to suggest that Clyde would turn rogue. And unlike most serial killers, there was no real physical, mental, or sexual abuse, save for the normal discipline by families of the day. And it's quite possible, if the family had stayed in the isolation of the country in Tellico, Texas, then no one would ever have heard the name Clyde Barrow. However, the Barrow children were not about to settle for the poverty-stricken, hard-working life their parents had endured. And one by one, Clyde's older brothers and sisters abandoned farming and looked for a better life in the city, where they could have fun and make a good living. Clyde's oldest brother, Jack, was first to move after he married a local girl and moved to Dallas. Two of his sisters soon followed and started working in the ever-expanding hair and beauty industry. Buck also followed, although as we will learn later, he took a different path. Henry and Cumie relied on their children to make a living working on the farm. And with four of them gone, they were finding it impossible to work the land. In 1922, they packed up all their possessions in a wagon, and along with their three remaining children, they moved to Dallas. At the time, Clyde was 12 years old, but to start with, the life in Dallas was worse than their previous life. Impoverished farmers were not welcome in the up-and-coming city, and the Barrows were soon banished to the outskirts of West Dallas, where they joined other impoverished families who had made the same move and were now living in tents and outhouses and sharing single water supply. Although initially, the Barrows did not even have the luxury of a tent, and Henry, Cumie, and three children slept under their old wagon next to their horse and relied on handouts from the Salvation Army. But the ever-resourceful Henry started collecting scrap and eventually made enough money to buy a shack on the site, so at least the family had a roof over their heads. During the difficult period, the Barrows spent at the West Dallas camp. Often, Clyde and his two sisters were sent to stay at their uncle's farm in Corsica to shield them from the ever-increasing lawlessness that was developing on the camp. At the age of 15, Clyde was lured away from the camp to the bright lights of the city and had ambitions of becoming a musician, although he managed to keep up his schooling in between sleeping rough or on his sister's floor. Although this didn't last long, and he was soon enticed by the pretty women of the city and the sharp-dressed men, and aspired to be like them. He got himself a job at the Brown Cracker and Candy Company, earning a dollar a day. But he soon realized this was nowhere near enough to fund the extravagant, sharp-suited lifestyle he yearned. And his background in West Dallas came with a stigma, meaning he didn't fit in and was often snubbed by those he strived to be like. They were not interested in being friends with, let alone dating a boy from West Dallas. In fact, Clyde's background even prevented him from dating girls who were also from West Dallas camp, as the Barrow family were considered the lowest of the low. However, Clyde was not willing to accept this. He wanted to be part of the finer side of city life, so set about controlling his own destiny to get where he wanted to be, and at first, he was willing to work legitimately for it. After realizing he had no prospects at Cracker and Candy, he soon moved on to Procter & Gamble and the United States Glass Company, where he worked as a glazier. He even tried to enlist in the Navy, and even had a USN tattooed on his arm, but was eventually turned down due to an illness he had suffered as a child. A dejected Clyde was determined not to resign himself to a life of impoverished drudgery, and took inspiration from the young men who took control of their destiny by breaking the law. So, Clyde started to supplement his factory earnings by stealing chickens from backyards and selling them at the age of just 16. Clyde had his first brush with the law when he was picked up for such chicken thefts. On this occasion, he wasn't jailed, but was severely reprimanded by the police and his parents. It was the start of a slippery slope, and to add to his desire to make money, Clyde also had a girl to impress. Her name was Eleanor B. Williams. She was of higher status than Clyde, and he was utterly smitten. He even tattooed her initials, EBW, on his arm, and he was soon telling anyone who would listen that they were engaged to be married. However, in late 1926, they had a huge argument, and Eleanor left Dallas to stay with relatives in East Texas. Clyde was bereft, and decided he had to get Eleanor back at all costs, so he somehow came up with the money to rent a car. And, in an audacious move, he invited Eleanor's mother to join him as he drove to East Dallas to reconcile with her. But it wasn't long before the local sheriff came looking for him. Clyde had broken the terms of the car rental by driving out of town, but instead of facing the sheriff, he hid from him and left Eleanor, her mother, and the rental car in East Dallas, while he hitched a lift back to Dallas. This time, Clyde was not let off with a caution, and he was duly arrested, and his first mugshots were taken. Since there was no damage to the car, the rental company decided to drop the charges, and Clyde was released. But he was now on police radar, and that mugshot would come back to haunt him. Ultimately, his relationship with Eleanor didn't last, and just 3 weeks after being released for the rental debacle, Clyde was arrested again, this time with his elder brother Buck, over the theft of turkeys. By now, Buck had two failed marriages behind him, three children, and several brushes with the law. But Clyde still idolized him. On this occasion, Buck took the blame and served a week in jail. But the boys were now known to the law and became known as the Barrow Boys. They were marked men, and any sniff of theft, it was the Barrows the police came looking for. This unfounded harassment manifested in Clyde a deep hatred and contempt for the law, and only reinforced his view that to get what he wanted in life meant he needed to disregard the law he had no respect for. and although he continued working, he was increasingly involving himself in higher revenue crimes. With the emergence of the automobile, he found car theft was an easy way to make money. A stolen car, repainted and disguised in good condition, could bring Clyde in $100. That was a lot of money in the 1920s. This newfound illicit wealth meant Clyde was dressed better and realizing dreams of fitting in with the city slickers. And he had acquired a string of lady admirers and added the names Annie and Grace to his tattoo collection. He then met a woman called Gladys, who demanded the finer things in life. This just added to Clyde's need to make money. Because of the attention the police in Dallas paid him, he started committing his car thefts out of town. He was also clever and increasingly dodged the police, who could often find no evidence to charge him. And getting one up on them only fueled Clyde's determination to continue his crimes. It wasn't long before Clyde paired up with Frank Claus, a petty criminal who targeted houses of the wealthy. And along with his brother Buck, the gang were taking more and more chances, meaning it was only a matter of time before they got caught. In the fall of 1929, the trio were arrested on suspicion of planning to rob a lumberyard, but remarkably they got away with it, due to a lack of evidence. However, their luck was about to run out. On November the 29th, 1929, Clyde Buck and another accomplice, Sidney Moore, drove from Dallas to the small town of Henrietta in a stolen Buick. After abandoning the vehicle and swapping it for a Ford, they broke into a house, but the haul was not what they were expecting. Just a few bits of jewelry and a small amount of cash. Disappointed with their work, they decided to break into another garage in Denton on their trip back home to Dallas. And after breaking in and being unable to crack the safe, they decided to load it into the stolen Ford. However, they were spotted by a passing patrol car and a chase ensued. Clyde, who was driving, soon smashed up his car's front axle when he hit a curb, and the trio took off on foot. The police started shooting, and Buck was hit in the legs, and Moore surrendered. But Clyde kept running and managed to escape and laid low before hitching back to Dallas. This time, there was overwhelming evidence to charge the men, although only Buck and Moore were convicted, and Buck was jailed for 4 years. The shame that Buck's imprisonment brought on Clyde's family, coupled with his own very close call, should have been enough to make Clyde reconsider his criminal ways. After all, he was only 19 and had his whole life ahead of him. But unlike Buck, who had been shaken up by the ordeal and promised his parents he would end his criminal ways once he had served his time, Clyde made no such promise. He did steer away from the bad influences of Frank Claus and reconnected with friends from his childhood on the camp. However, this change in friends would ultimately influence the rest of his life and culminate in his brutal death. On January the 5th, 1930, one of Clyde's rediscovered friends, Clarence Clay, invited Clyde to a house party at 105 Herbert Street in West Dallas. Also attending the party was 19-year-old Bonnie Parker. Bonnie Parker. Bonnie Elizabeth Parker was born on October the 1st, 1910, in Rowena, Texas. She was one of three children born to Emma and Charles Parker. From an early age, Bonnie's mother ingrained in her children that they were a cut above everyone else, and far removed from the local farming families they lived amongst. Emma was a typical social butterfly, and her life revolved around the church. She also took every opportunity to show off her three beautiful children, dressing them all smartly in starched bows and ruffles. Bonnie was particularly cute, with her curls and bright blue eyes. Life was good for the family until Charles unexpectedly passed away in 1914, and Emma was left with three small children and no means of supporting them. She packed up her belongings, and the family moved 240 miles away to Cement City in Dallas, where she moved in with her parents. The adjustment from being a lady of substance in Rowena to barely getting by in Dallas was hard for Emma, but she found work as a seamstress and continued to see herself and her children as high class, and paraded herself and her children around as if they were royalty. However, from an early age, it was Bonnie who was the most disruptive and would do anything, however outrageous, to stand out in the crowd, a trait that continued throughout her school years into adulthood. Bonnie also had a temper, especially when she couldn't get her own way, and she expected her friends and family to lavish her with gifts and praise, and believed that when she was older, her name would be in lights on Broadway, and she would have a glamorous Hollywood career. As Bonnie grew into a young woman, she wore the latest fashions and makeup, and at the age of just 15, she posed for a studio glamour shot, the sort of photo you see of 1920s women gazing into the camera with tilted head and doe eyes. But in reality, Bonnie was a dreamer, and there was little chance of her fulfilling her dream in a place like Cement City. The only possibility she had of leading the glamorous and happy life she craved was to marry well, and that is exactly what Bonnie intended to do. In her mind, she would find the perfect man, have the perfect marriage, and her life would be as romantic as the movies she craved to star in. Bonnie thought she found that in Roy Thornton, a man she met while in high school, and someone who appeared to have money to spoil her. Bonnie quickly fell in love with Roy, and even had two red hearts tattooed on her inner thigh, with the names Bonnie and Roy inside them. And just 2 weeks before her 16th birthday, on September the 25th, 1926, the pair were married. But more or less from the start, the marriage was a disaster. In her rush to marry, Bonnie had forgotten to ask how her new husband made his money, and it was soon apparent it was by breaking the law. Roy would leave Bonnie for weeks, even months at a time, and eventually she and Roy moved back in with her mother. As far as the marriage was concerned, this made things worse, and soon Bonnie suspected Roy was cheating on her. This, coupled with Bonnie's inability to have children, meant the marriage was doomed, and the fairy tale Bonnie had imagined for herself was quickly imploding. In January 1928, Roy left for a job and didn't return for a whole year, during which time Bonnie got herself a job as a waitress. It's also rumoured that she subsided her income through prostitution, although there is no proof of this. When Roy finally returned, Bonnie declared the marriage was over, and just a few months later, Roy was jailed for 5 years for robbery. And although they never officially divorced, Bonnie never had any contact with him again. She continued waitressing and moved to a more upmarket restaurant called Marco's. However, after the stock market crash of October 1929, eventually Marco's closed and Bonnie found herself broke and still living with her mother. Despite being thoroughly miserable, she still believed in her dreams, and when she was invited to a party her brother and his wife were holding, things were about to change. Bonnie and Clyde. From the moment they set eyes on each other at the party, their fate was sealed. Clyde wasn't Bonnie's usual type. He was short and not as good-looking as Roy, but he was a snappy dresser and drove a fancy car. Never mind that it was stolen. And for Clyde, Bonnie was perfect. She was pretty and petite, an important feature for Clyde, who was only 5'5.5". The pair also shared mutual self-worth. They both aspired to be better than their upbringings, with a ruthless determination to rise above the poverty they had both endured. And if that meant breaking the law, so be it. They fell madly in love and were inseparable. It's not clear whether Clyde initially discussed his brushes with the law with Bonnie, but she was about to find out anyway. Just a few months into their relationship, the police arrived at Bonnie's mother's house looking for Clyde, and he was immediately arrested. Clyde had escaped charges on previous occasions and believed this time would be no different, so he quietly accompanied the police to be interviewed. But for Bonnie, it was all too much. She flew into hysterics, begging and pleading with the officers not to arrest him, but to no avail, and Clyde was driven off with the officers, leaving Bonnie collapsed in a heap sobbing. Her mother warned her of Clyde, but Bonnie was not about to listen, and made it her mission to stand by him with whatever charges were thrown at him, and like the movies she loved to watch, would save him with her love. For Clyde, this arrest was more serious than the previous ones. It wasn't the Dallas police who wanted to question him. They were just acting on instructions from law enforcement in the cities of Denton and Waco. Clyde was held in Dallas jail before waiting a transfer, and Bonnie made regular visits and wrote him long lingering letters, declaring her undying love. Bonnie also tried to bond with the Barrows. However, despite getting close to Clyde's sisters, who were impressed by her beauty and glamour, his mother, Cumie, was less impressed. The heavy makeup and trendy clothes Bonnie wore was everything Cumie despised in a woman, and she took an instant dislike to her. She was certainly not the sort of girl her precious son should be associating with. Clyde was transferred to Denton Jail, where he faced charges linked to the robbery he escaped and Buck was jailed for. However, yet again he escaped conviction after the jury decided there wasn't enough evidence. However, as soon as he was released, he was rearrested by McLennan County law enforcement in connection with various car thefts and robberies in Waco. This time he wasn't so lucky, and in the face of overwhelming evidence, Clyde pleaded guilty to 7 counts of theft and received a 2-year sentence for each crime. But the judge agreed he could serve them all at the same time, so instead of serving a total of 14 years, he only had to serve 2. Both Bonnie and Cumie were devastated, but relieved the sentence wasn't too long, and Bonnie stayed in Waco, determined to stand by her man. Clyde was due to be transferred from Waco to Huntsville, 90 miles away, where Buck was serving his sentence. Although unknown to Clyde, Buck had escaped and had made his way back to the family in Dallas, and Clyde was determined to do the same, but to achieve this, he needed the help of Bonnie. On Tuesday the 11th of March 1930, during one of Bonnie's visits, Clyde whispered to her details of his getaway plan. Clyde was being held in jail with Waco man William Turner, who before his conviction lived with his parents nearby. In the house, Turner had hidden a revolver. Clyde asked Bonnie to go to the house, retrieve the gun, and smuggle it into the jail that evening. He promised her, once he had broken out and got clear of Waco, he would come back for her, and they could be together. It's worth remembering, Bonnie had never broken the law before, and although she was the lover of a convicted criminal, she was not a criminal herself. But that was about to change. Bonnie agreed to the plan, treating it as some kind of romantic gesture to prove her love for a man. In her mind, being on the run with Clyde was more exciting than returning to her family in Dallas and living the humdrum life she had lived before she met Clyde. Clyde passed her a note with a little map of the Turner house and the location of the gun. Underneath he scribbled, "You are the sweetest baby in the world to me. I love you." Bonnie carried out Clyde's instructions and smuggled the gun into the prison that evening, concealed in a belt she had hidden under her dress. Clyde, Turner, and a third prisoner, Emery Abernathy, commenced their escape plan at 7:30 that evening. Turner called to one of the jailers that he felt sick and asked for some milk to settle his stomach. The officer obliged, but when he returned with the milk, Emery pointed the gun at him from his adjacent cell and demanded he hand over the keys. They warned him if he made a sound, he would be dead. After locking him in one of the cells, the 3 men made their way down the stairs, where they threatened the only other jailer in the building to stay silent. The trio then made their escape, pursued by one of the jailers who shot at them. But they were all well out of range. Clyde soon stole a car, and they were away. The next day, the local Waco newspapers were plastered with photos and accounts of the jailbreak, but the articles appeared to ridicule the escapees, calling them baby dumbbells. Bonnie was at her wit's end. She was pleased with Clyde that he had made it out, but had heard nothing from him, and began to fret that she wouldn't see him again. She decided to make her way back to Dallas to her mother's house, where she would wait for Clyde to come and get her, so they could start their new exciting life together. Bonnie didn't tell her mother what Clyde had done, and hoped she wouldn't read it in the newspapers. But as the days went on with no word from Clyde, Bonnie grew more and more hysterical, believing she had been cruelly tricked, used, and dumped. Then 5 days after the breakout, she received a telegraph from Clyde. It was from Illinois. The message was brief. It said he was alright and he'd be in touch. Bonnie was ecstatic. However, this was short-lived, as news filtered through that the escapees had been recaptured after a bungled robbery. And on Friday, March the 21st, just 10 days after their escape from Waco, all 3 escapees found themselves back behind bars in Waco. This time, though, Bonnie wasn't there to support her wayward lover. She had been so traumatized by the whole incident that she decided to stay in Dallas. She didn't break it off with Clyde, but was no longer willing to support him and visited him just once while he was in Waco. After the breakout, the courts were not so lenient to Clyde, and he was ordered to serve the full 14 years of his original sentence, and eventually ended up in the dreaded Huntsville prison, where he lied about his age, saying he was just 18 instead of 20. He also said Bonnie was his wife, so he could continue writing to her. During his time in Huntsville, he was charged with several other robberies and misdemeanors. The most serious of these was the murder of 20-year-old Buster Gouge. He was eventually found not guilty of the killing and other charges due to insufficient evidence, although many in Houston, where the crime was committed, still believe that Buster was Clyde's first murder victim. Despite these new charges being dropped, it wasn't long before Clyde was sent to East Ham Prison Farm, the most feared, filthiest hellhole in the Huntsville prison system, and a place usually only afforded to the most hardened, dangerous criminals, something that at this point Clyde was not. Clyde had a torrid time in Eastham. He was forced to work 10 hours a day in the cotton fields and was regularly beaten and starved. But perhaps the most devastating and humiliating experience for Clyde was the systematic rape by fellow inmate Ed Crowder. The once cheeky chappy and small-time crook was now reduced to being Crowder's prison thing, who attacked and violated him at will. But Clyde Barrow was not going to stand for it any longer, and he plotted with fellow inmate Aubrey Scaly to murder Crowder, with Scaly taking the blame. On October the 29th, 1931, Clyde concealed a lead pipe in his trousers and lured Crowder to the shower block, where he savagely beat him over the head, fracturing his skull and killing him. As was the plan, Scaly was waiting in the wings and finished the job by repeatedly stabbing Crowder with a homemade shiv. He then took full responsibility, and no questions were asked. Scaly had nothing to lose, as he was already sentenced to 99 years. Clyde had committed his first murder without flinching and was totally remorseless. However, it wasn't just Crowder that was out of his life. It seemed Bonnie was too. She was tired of waiting for Clyde, and her letters became less and less frequent until they stopped altogether, and she moved on with someone new. Clyde was devastated, but wasn't about to give up on the love of his life, and with his family campaigning for his release, he had a plan. Clyde's dad Henry had set up a small gas station. It made very little money, and he subsided his income by selling moonshine. Clyde saw this as a business opportunity, and suggested he expanded the garage by selling automobile parts. And he promised his family when he was released, he would set up an auto repair business alongside his father and go straight. Of course, there was one small problem. Clyde still had 12 years left on his sentence. So he took drastic action. It wasn't uncommon for inmates to self-mutilate to get softer jobs inside the main prison, and the best chance of this was to cut off either of their toes, fingers, hands, or feet. And if they were badly mutilated enough, they would be deemed unfit to work in the fields and given a softer option. So on January the 27th, 1923, Clyde used an axe to cut off his big toe on his left foot and part of his second toe. The ploy worked, and Clyde never worked in the Eastham farm fields again. But ironically, it was unnecessary, as just 6 days after the incident, Clive received the news that thanks to his mother's pleading to get him paroled, the Texas governor had agreed to his release. Clyde had spent nearly a year and a half at Eastham. During that time, he had lost Bonnie, chopped his toes off, murdered a man, been raped, and worked half to death. But he was now a free man, and when he hobbled out of prison, he swore that he would rather die than ever go back there. Reunited. In February 1932, Clyde limped up to the front door of Bonnie's mother's house in Dallas. As soon as Bonnie saw him, she embraced him in full view of her new, soon-to-be ex-boyfriend. Clyde had promised he'd come back for her, and just like in the movies, he had. Clyde settled back into life in Dallas, but found it difficult to find a job, as the police were aware that he was back, and the old routine of picking him up for every petty crime in the area resumed. His plan to expand his father's business never materialized, so eventually he moved away, without Bonnie, to Framington, Massachusetts, where he was promised a job in the construction industry. But he lasted just 2 weeks before returning to Dallas to the same old routine of hiring and firing. This is when Clyde made a decision that would impact not only his life, but also Bonnie's. He decided, from now on, he was going to make a living by breaking the law. It's worth remembering, Clyde had options, because although he was known to police in Dallas, he wasn't known in other cities. And if he had really wanted to go straight, he could have easily moved with Bonnie and started over where no one would know who he was. However, Clyde thought the world, in particular the cops and prison system, had treated him unfairly, and he was more interested in getting revenge than earning an honest living. And with Bonnie as a willing accomplice, that is exactly what he intended to do. Whilst being transported to Eastham Prison, Clyde had met Ralph Foltz, and the two had become close. The pair vowed that when they got out, they would seek revenge on those who treated them so appallingly in prison. They also planned a mass prison break, but to achieve this, they needed money. So Clyde Fultz and another acquaintance, Raymond Hamilton, formed a gang and hit the road. Although details are scarce, it's widely believed the gang robbed their first bank in Lawrence, Kansas, in March of 1932, and Fultz later claimed they stole thousands of dollars in that first raid, and used some of the money to buy high-powered weapons, including a submachine gun. The rest of the cash was used to buy the silence of Clyde's friends and family, something Clyde regularly did throughout his criminal career, and something that helped him and Bonnie in the future when they were on the run. However, the gang still managed to retain enough money for the long-planned prison breakout, and in April 1932, they headed to the Texas Panhandle to try and recruit some former inmates to help them in their bid. But the trip was not a success, and they garnered little support. First kidnap. On the journey back from Texas, their stolen car broke down in Electra, a small town close to the Oklahoma border, and their presence in the town aroused suspicion, and a local businessman, A.F. McCormick, alerted the police. Chief James Taylor and another officer went to investigate and chased the gang as they ran off, but eventually the lawman apprehended them and threatened them with arrest. This is when Fultz pulled a gun and pointed it in the face of Taylor. McCormick also arrived on the scene, and the gang saw this as an opportunity and to escape, so at gunpoint, they bundled the two lawmen and McCormick into his car, and with Clyde at the wheel, they drove 10 miles to a ranch where they released the three kidnapped men and drove off. But they didn't get far when their car ran out of gas, forcing them to hijack a passing mail cart at gunpoint, and driving it and the mailman 100 miles across the border, before dumping him on the side of the road along with his mailbags. This apparent act of mercy was the start of the public perception of Clyde as a soft-hearted man, and not the cold-blooded killer the police wanted to portray. But that mailman was so terrified for his life, he never really got over the 100-mile ordeal. Despite these setbacks, the gang pushed ahead with their prison break plan, but they needed the help of Bonnie. So on April 17, 1932, they picked her up from her mother's house and headed towards Eastham Farm Prison. The plan was for Bonnie to pretend to be Aubrey Scaly's cousin, so she could visit him and tell him about the bust-out plan. But it all went wrong when they stopped at a store in Kaufman to buy ammunition and decided they wanted the smart guns on display as well. So that evening, they went back to rob the store, but they were spotted by a watchman and shots were fired. This triggered the town's alarm, and the local townsmen came out in force. After a frantic chase, they all managed to escape in two stolen cars, but as they left, there was a deluge of rain, and they soon found themselves bogged down and stuck in the mud. So Clyde decided his only option was to steal two mules from a nearby farm, and with himself and Bonnie on one mule, and Flutes on the other, they made their escape. As soon as they could, they traded the mules for a car, but again it ran out of fuel. All the while they were still being pursued by the townsmen, who eventually caught up with them, and they ended up in a shootout where Fultz was shot in the arm. During the onslaught, Clyde made a run for it, leaving Bonnie and Fultz to face the music. But as he took off, he promised Bonnie he would be back for her. Bonnie and Fultz were captured and held at Kemp, in a tiny calaboose in Texas, that looked more like a shed than a jailhouse, and the pair were on show to the townsfolk who came by to gawk at them. The next day, they were moved to the county jail, where both refused to name Clyde as the third member of the gang. However, Fultz was quickly linked with the Electra kidnapping, and was swiftly tried and sentenced to 10 years, and moved to Wichita Falls Jail. Bonnie was now left alone in Kaufman, and it was while languishing in jail that Bonnie wrote many of the poems she later became known for. They featured thoughts on her life sprinkled with the added fantasy life she dreamed of, and some of the phrases she used in them, that she had likely picked up from the movies she watched, convinced people that these were the words of a hardened outlaw. However, at this stage, nothing was further from the truth. While Bonnie and Fultz languished in jail, Clyde continued with his criminal lifestyle and had formed another gang. On April 3, 1932, he planned to rob John Butcher's combination filling station and jewelry store in Texas. It's unclear which member of the gang knocked on Butcher's door, asking to buy guitar strings, but Butcher sensed something wasn't right about the man and reached for his gun. One of the gang members retaliated, firing a shot at Butcher's chest, killing him instantly. The gang then robbed the store and made off with $40 and around $2,500 worth of jewellery, as well as Butcher's gun. Authorities were outraged and believed Clyde and his old friend Frank Claus were responsible, and a $250 reward was offered for their capture. But they were wrong. It was actually Raymond Hamilton who was Clyde's accomplice, not Klaus. Clyde was now a wanted man. By June of that year, Bonnie was released from prison and all charges were dropped as she went back to her mother's house in Dallas and promised she would have nothing more to do with Clyde. However, it wasn't long before she announced she was leaving home, claiming she had a new job in Wichita Falls. In truth, she was joining Clyde, who had rented a little hideout in the area, one of several hideouts the pair lived in over the next 2 years, as they tried to dodge the law. During these stays, Clyde honed his gun and driving skills and gained extensive knowledge of various states, knowledge that proved useful when trying to outwit the law. This, coupled with his incredible driving skills and ability to push the most basic car to the limit, made him very hard to catch. His weapon of choice was a Browning automatic BAR, a gun capable of firing a magazine of 20 bullets in seconds with a single pull of the trigger, and armed with all these skills, Clyde was a deadly combination. Policing at this time was in its infancy, and Clyde had more than enough nous to outfox the law. They had, however, just introduced a primitive shortwave radio communication system, and tuning into police conversations became a favourite pastime for many people. Not surprisingly, the Barrow filling station had a shortwave radio that was in regular use. And in the summer of 1932, Clyde dropped Bonnie off at the station prior to a payroll stick-up and told her to listen over the radio to see if he made his getaway. Clyde had paired up with his former accomplice, Raymond Hamilton, and the pair, along with another man, planned to hold up the Newhoff Brothers packing company to try and steal the payroll. The raid was a success, and the gang got away with $440 in cash. Clyde picked up Bonnie, and they headed to an abandoned farmhouse where they laid low for a few days. On Friday the 5th of August 1932, the gang took a chance and headed back to Dallas, dropping Bonnie off at her mother's as they passed through. They then drove towards Oklahoma, but en route they spotted an outdoor dance near Stringtown, so they decided to stop for a drink. Although Clyde, who rarely drank, stayed in the car with Hamilton, while the other member, believed to be Ross Dyer, joined in dancing and drinking. At some point during the evening, Atoka County Sheriff Charles Maxwell and his deputy, Eugene Shepherd, dropped by and noticed Clyde and Hamilton sat on their car, so they walked over to have a word. It's unsure why, but Sheriff Maxwell threatened to arrest the pair, but before he could explain, Clyde and Hamilton opened fire, hitting the sheriff 6 times. His deputy rushed to his aid and was shot in the chest and died instantly. Miraculously, Maxwell survived but sustained serious injuries. All hell broke out as the revelers heard the shots and Clyde and Hamilton tried to escape in their car, only for it to clip the curb and roll over. They managed to escape and ran before stealing another vehicle that then broke down. Clyde used his charm and acting skills to dupe a local farming family into believing they needed a lift to the hospital, as they had an injured woman with them. The 20-year-old son, Haskell Owens, agreed to drive them to their family car, but once inside, Clyde held a gun to his head and ordered him to drive the opposite direction. Luckily for Owens, the car broke down and he managed to escape into the night. Eventually, Clyde and Raymond stole yet another car and managed to make their way back to Dallas. At the time, the police had no idea who the cop killers were, but were determined to hunt them down. And they had posses of lawmen swarming across 5 counties of Oklahoma. But all they came up with was the abandoned vehicles. Back in Dallas, Clyde was laying low, and he sent a friend to pick up Bonnie. Once the pair were reunited, they hit the road again, but the law had gotten the break they were looking for. After they arrested a man who was heading out of Springville to Dallas on a bus, the man was Ross Dyer. Initially, Dyer denied any involvement with the killing of Eugene Shepherd, but for whatever reason, he changed his mind, and the following week, the police had the names of Clyde Barrow and Raymond Hamilton. But the information he gave them came with a warning. When Dyer declared Clyde and Raymond would not give up easily and had vowed to fight to the death to avoid the law. Despite the warning, the police were confident they would catch the killers by the end of the week. The problem the police had in 1932 was that they couldn't pursue criminals outside their own areas, even suspected murderers. They weren't allowed to cross city, county, or state lines. Clyde and Raymond would have been aware of this, so Bonnie suggested they all head to New Mexico, where no one would know about them, and they could stay with her aunt, Nellie Parker. When they arrived, Nellie had no idea that Bonnie was travelling with fugitives, and although she was uneasy about the strangers, she welcomed the visit from her niece, who introduced Clyde as her husband, James White, and Raymond as Jack Smith. But Nellie soon became suspicious of the fancy car and amount of cash the men had, so she alerted the local sheriff's office, who sent Deputy Sheriff Joe Johns to investigate. Bonnie answered the door, and using the code word, getting dressed, she warned Clyde and Raymond there was trouble on the doorstep. The pair panicked. They had left their guns in the car, so frantically searched the house for a weapon and found a shotgun in a closet. They then exited the house by the back door and crept up on Johns as he examined their car. With the shotgun pointing at him, they bundled him into the vehicle. Clyde, Raymond, and Bonnie followed, leaving a distraught Nellie sobbing on her knees as they drove away. The kidnapping of the deputy sent the region into meltdown, and officers from the state of New Mexico and Texas were drafted in to search for the officer, and many feared the worst. But Johns was unharmed. He was about to embark on a terrifying journey with Clyde at the wheel, and for most of it had a gun held to his side by Raymond. Johns also realized through conversations he heard that he was likely in a car with murderers. He even struck up a conversation with Bonnie, who they referred to as Honey. Finally, after 20 hours of almost non-stop driving, Clyde stopped the car several miles outside of San Antonio and let Johns go. Allegedly, the last words Clyde said to him were, "You sure have caused us trouble, Sheriff." After letting Johns go, Clyde stole another car, and Raymond drove the original one as they headed to Houston. But the police had been alerted to the car theft and set up a roadblock on a bridge between Victoria and Houston. They planned to turn on flashlights if they spotted a car and prepare to ambush. But as Clyde approached the bridge, he caught a glimmer of the flashlight and made an instant U-turn, closely followed by Raymond in the other car. And through a hail of bullets, they both managed to escape. They soon abandoned both cars and somehow made it back to one of their hideouts in West Dallas. But the names of Clyde Barrow, Bonnie Parker, and Raymond Hamilton were now known widely by the police, and the trio needed to get away from Dallas. They decided to head to Michigan, where Raymond's father lived. Apparently, Bonnie and Clyde stayed in Michigan for a short time before leaving Raymond with his father and headed to the Midwest, and this is where the story gets hazy. It's always been portrayed that the couple then spent a short period in Kansas and Missouri, where Bonnie changed her appearance slightly by curling her hair and changing her makeup, and the couple had fun as a loved-up, carefree couple. But that is what the family, films, and the press want you to believe. It seems the reality was completely different and far from being romantic. Much of the time, they were drifting, sleeping in their car, and taking turns to look out for trouble. The only money they had was from small store robberies and the occasional small town bank. Most of their food came from out of cans, and they traveled hundreds of miles in stinking dirty clothes and starving. Despite this, they still made occasional visits to Dallas to stay in touch with family and stock up on supplies and clean clothes. In fact, on one occasion, they met up with family. Bonnie accidentally shot herself in the foot, causing serious damage to her little toe. During this not-so-romantic time on the run, Bonnie continued to write her numerous fantasy poems about the life she dreamed of, rather than the life she actually had. The pair also reveled in seeing their names in the newspapers, often accused of crimes they hadn't actually committed. What is true about this period is they did manage to evade the law, and although they left a few clues here and there, mostly stolen cars, there was nothing that would lead to their arrest. There is one crime, however, that was committed on October the 11th, 1932, that Clyde always denied he was involved with, but it seems very likely that he did commit. It happened at a small grocery store in Sherman, Texas. The storekeepers Howard Hall and Homer Glaze were shutting up around 6:30 in the evening when a man walked in fitting Clyde's description. He asked for bread, meat, and eggs, but as he prepared to pay, he pulled out a pistol and ordered the takings from the till. As he made his way out of the shop, Hall and Glaze pursued him, but the robber hit back and kicked out at them and fired 4 shots at Hall, killing him. He then turned the gun on Glaze, but it failed to fire. In the aftermath of the murder, Glaze was shown a photograph of Clyde and confirmed he was the man who had killed his friend and stole the takings. Despite this positive sighting, Clyde always claimed they hung the crime on him for luck. After the supposed store killing, the bounty on Clyde's head increased, and the incident meant visits to their family in Dallas became less frequent and only fleeting. But on Christmas Day 1932, they were in Dallas and ran into Clyde's younger brother, Al C., and his friend, William Daniel Jones, known as W.D., who had a quantity of moonshine. By now, Bonnie had started drinking quite heavily, although Clyde hardly touched it. During the meeting, Clyde asked W.D. if he wanted to join him and Bonnie on the road, saying they needed an extra pair of eyes to watch out for the law so they could get some sleep. At the time, W.D. was just a teenager and was in awe of Bonnie and Clyde and their infamous reputation. He readily agreed to Clyde's offer, thinking it would be a non-stop adventure. Although it wasn't long before he realized it was no adventure, and the very afternoon he was recruited, Bonnie, Clyde, and W.D. tried to steal a car from outside of a house in Temple, Texas. All the family were gathered inside the house for the festivities and spotted the theft. The owner of the car, Doyle Johnson, flew out of the house to try and protect his property and ended up in a struggle with Clyde. Both W.D. and Clyde fired their weapons and hit Doyle in the neck before speeding off in his car and met up with Bonnie, who was waiting a few blocks away in another stolen car. Realizing the police were on their tail, they abandoned Doyle's car and sped off with Bonnie. After a few miles, Clyde ordered W.D. to get out of the car and climb a telephone pole and cut the wires. W.D. was now part of Bonnie and Clyde's life, and the next day it was reported Doyle Johnson, a 27-year-old husband and father, had died from his injuries. Surprisingly, Clyde was not initially a suspect for the killing, and other men were accused. But after a few months, it was realized Clyde was responsible for the crime. In early 1933, Clyde's former partner in crime, Raymond Hamilton, was arrested, and his link to Clyde was quickly established. Clyde was troubled by his friend's capture, as he was being tried for the murder of John Butcher and the possible death penalty. So he started hatching a plan to break Raymond out of jail, and first he visited Raymond's older sister at her home in West Dallas. However, unbeknown to him, the house was being staked out inside and out by police who were investigating a separate, unrelated bank robbery. When Clyde knocked the door, Raymond's younger sister opened it, and Clyde spotted the officers in the front room and immediately opened fire. They returned fire, and a shootout ensued. W.D., who witnessed the commotion from a waiting car with Bonnie, also joined in shooting randomly at the officers. During the exchange, Tarrant County Deputy Sheriff Malcolm Davis was shot by Clyde and died before he reached the hospital. Clyde, Bonnie, and W.D. escaped in their car. The murder of Davis shocked the newly installed Fort Worth Sheriff, Smoot Schmidt, and over the next few days, he deployed several groups of armed deputies and police officers in the Dallas area. But as was usual, no one was talking, and they still were not certain who the shooter was. And as Clyde was known to pay the locals and his family for their silence, it was making identifying him even more difficult. However, they got a breakthrough when reports started to filter through that the culprit had a woman accomplice. After they murdered Davis, Bonnie and Clyde laid low while away from Dallas, and little was heard from them in the weeks that followed. In late January 1933, they re-emerged in Springfield, Missouri, where a motorcycle officer named Thomas Purcell flagged them down, only to be faced with a gun pointed at him by Clyde, who ordered the officer to get in the back of the car with W.D. and a cache of weapons and cash. In the front was Bonnie and Clyde, who referred to themselves as Bud and Sis. By now, Bonnie had also dyed her hair red. The gang drove Purcell to an isolated spot near Joplin, where they let him go. These random acts of mercy were one of the reasons the public were getting carried away with the romance and seemingly softer side of Bonnie and Clyde's saga. Back in Dallas, Cumie Barrow was on a mission, as well as her unstinting support for Clyde. She was also determined to get her other son Buck released from prison, and eventually, her Dodge determination paid off, when he was finally released with a full pardon in March 1933. Unlike Clyde, prison had changed Buck for the better, and after his release, he vowed to settle down with his new wife and stayed out of trouble. However, his concern for his younger brother Clyde soon scuppered any dreams of leading a normal life. Buck announced that he wanted to meet with Clyde and tried to convince him to turn himself in an attempt to spare his life. Buck's wife was horrified and begged him not to, but eventually she agreed, and Buck, Blanche, and their dog Snowball made the trip to Joplin, Missouri to meet up with Clyde. Once in Joplin, they all decided to rent an apartment for a few weeks, and chose a comparatively luxurious apartment with a double garage, two bedrooms, a kitchen/living area, and a bathroom. It was the first time in months that Bonnie, Clyde, and WD had spent in a proper bed with toilet facilities, and the group enjoyed nights out and home-cooked food together. However, it wasn't long before Clyde and WD started making trips out to rob local businesses. The thefts angered Bonnie as she finally felt settled, and her and Clyde argued. As was the usual, the fights ended up physical, with Clyde hitting Bonnie across the room. It was no secret that Clyde hit Bonnie during these ferocious spats, although she often gave as good as she got, and the pair would always end up making up pretty quickly. But after just 2 weeks at the apartment, the atmosphere was getting edgy, and the group decided to make plans to leave. Then at around 4 p.m. on April the 13th, 1933, two Joplin police officers, accompanied by two troopers from Missouri State Police, turned up. They had no idea who was in the apartment, but had suspected illegal activity, possibly bootlegging or car theft. Also in attendance was Wes Harriman, a father of six, whose job it was to deliver warrants. As the officers approached the apartment, they could see Clyde and WD trying to shut the garage door. Harry walked over to try and stop them, and he was met with a hail of number one buckshot, lead balls about the size of a pea. He had no chance, and was shot in the shoulder and neck, and died instantly. Harry McGinnis, another officer, managed to fire 3 shots from his patrol car before he too was showered with buckshot and fatally wounded. One of the other officers tried to shoot from behind the car while the other two ran to a nearby house to call for backup. Clyde shouted at Bonnie and Buck's wife to get in the car, but Snowball had run off, so Buck's wife ran after him. For a few moments the shooting stopped and Buck moved the dead policeman out of the way, and Clyde shunted the police car so they could make their getaway. Somehow the four of them had made it out, picking up guns as they fled. They then picked up Buck's wife a few blocks away, although there was no sign of her dog. All 5 of them were now murder suspects, and crucially, the apartment they had made their home for the past 2 weeks was now littered with evidence. Buck's wife had left her bag with a marriage license, Buck's pardon, and a camera in. There was no doubt now who the suspects were, and it was only a matter of time before the law caught up with them. The film roll in Buck's wife's camera was developed, and photos of the gang were revealed, as well as the now infamous photo of Bonnie and Clyde, with a gun and a cigar. The photo began to appear in newspapers and magazines, and cemented their position as celebrity outlaws. They were young, good-looking and well-dressed, and for Bonnie, they were now receiving the sort of attention she wanted, but for all the wrong reasons. Everyone knew the names and faces of Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. However, perhaps more immediately pressing to the gang was that they were injured. Clyde had a bullet fragment lodged in his chest that Bonnie prized out with a hairpin. But WD was far more seriously injured. He had been shot in the side just below his ribs, and the bullet had gone straight through and exited through his back. Clyde treated the wound with rubbing alcohol soaked on a rag, and he poked through the gaping hole with an elm branch. Buck had also suffered some bruising, but was otherwise fine. The gang decided to make their way back to Texas, unaware that the order from the police from Missouri to Texas was to shoot to kill. Over the next 2 weeks, the gang kept driving, stealing cars and guns along the way. They sped from state to state, passing through Texas to New Mexico, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, and Illinois, then doubled back through Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. It was a miserable existence, especially for WD, who was in pain, and wasn't helped by the growing tension in the gang. In particular, the hot tempers of both Buck and Clyde, and the deteriorating relationship between Bonnie and Buck's wife. By late April, WD had had enough, and when Clyde ordered him to steal a car, instead of returning to the rest of the gang, he sped off, leaving Clyde furious. The car belonged to Dillard Darby, and when he saw his car being stolen, he called out to Sophia Stone to help. The pair jumped in Sophia's car and tried to chase WD, but soon gave up. As they turned around to go back, they were halted by an angry Clyde who hit Darby on the back of his head with a pistol, and Bonnie pulled Sophia out of the car by her hair. The pair were then kidnapped. In the car, Bonnie struck up a conversation with their hostages and discovered that Dillard Darby was an undertaker and allegedly said to him, "I know we are going to get it sooner or later, and I know you would enjoy embalming us. Promise us you will." Eventually the hostages were let go in Arkansas, and Clyde gave them $5 to help them get home. On May the 12th, 1933, the gang made a failed attempt at robbing the Lucerne State Bank in Indiana. And as they made their escape, one of the locals tried to block their speeding car by throwing a block of wood in front of it. Clyde expertly avoided it and carried on, only to be slowed down again by a gathering crowd outside a church. Now, this is where the reports get exaggerated. It was reported in the press that all four members of the gang opened fire on the crowd, including the two women. However, this has always been denied by the family, who claimed neither of the women ever shot at anyone. Whatever the truth is, no one was seriously injured that day, but it did cement the belief that Bonnie was also a callous gun shooter, and possibly responsible for at least one murder, if not more. A week later, the gang robbed a bank in Minnesota and escaped with around $1,400. During this robbery, witnesses claim a woman and a man fired dozens of shots from the back of a getaway car. As Clyde would have been driving, the shooters were either Buck's wife, Buck, or Bonnie. Not long after the robbery, the gang made their way back to Dallas for one of their regular meetups with the family. In the past, when Bonnie and Clyde wanted to meet the family, they would drive to the barrow filling station in the dark and throw a Coca-Cola bottle with a note inside detailing a meeting place. They also kept in close contact with their families when they were on the road, sending anonymous postcards from the various places they ended up in. On this occasion, the gang treated their family members to clothes and other gifts using the money from their recent haul. As was usual, the Barrow family was still trying to get Buck and Bonnie to turn themselves in, believing a prison sentence was better than death. As usual, they failed. Bonnie told her mother, "I love him and I'm going to be with him till the end. When he dies, I want to die anyway." After the visit, Buck and his wife headed to western Oklahoma, while Bonnie and Clyde stayed in Dallas to look for WD. Eventually they tracked him down and he rejoined the gang, although it's unclear whether this was a forced decision. The trio arranged to meet up with Buck and Blanche at a bridge near Sire, Oklahoma. As usual, Clyde was driving at breakneck speed in the dark, and he missed a detour sign directing him around an unfinished bridge. By the time he realized, it was too late, and he slammed on his brakes, causing the car to fly into the air and hurtle towards the river. Two men sat nearby on the porch of their house, witnessed the crash, and ran over to help. WD and Clyde were bleeding and shaken, but not badly hurt, but Bonnie was unconscious and seriously injured. The acid from the car battery had splattered over her lower leg and was burning into her flesh. The two rescuers carried Bonnie to their house, and the woman of the house cleaned her up and tended to her wounds the best they could, but she was in a bad way and needed a doctor. However, Clyde wouldn't hear of it, fearing the law would get involved. But one of the men was suspicious and slipped out of the house to alert the sheriff. When Clyde realized the man was missing, things got tense, and a nervous WD ended up shooting one of the women in the hand as she headed for the door with her baby. Clyde quickly realized what was going on and waited outside the house, armed with the guns they retrieved from the car wreck. As predicted, Sheriff George Corey and Marshal Paul Hardy pulled up in their car and walked straight into the barrels of two shotguns. Clyde and WD took the officers hostage and carried a very unwell Bonnie into the officer's car. Before they left the house, they shot out the tires of the family car and then offered to pay the family for their trouble, which they refused. In the back of the car, Hardy cared for the injured Bonnie, and both officers showed her great kindness, on what must have been a terrifying journey. Clyde, Bonnie and W.D. finally reached Buck and Blosh, but they now had the added problem of two hostages. Apparently, Clyde was reluctant to shoot them, as Buck suggested, as he was grateful for how they had cared for Bonnie. So instead, he handcuffed them together and tied them to a tree with barbed wire and left them there. They later managed to free themselves and escape. The gang headed to Kansas, but Clyde, W.D. and Bonnie were suffering terribly from their injuries, and Blosh was worried they would all die. She decided to rent a tourist cabin in Kansas to try and lay low and recuperate. Slowly, Clyde and W.D. began to recover, but Bonnie was still in a bad way, so they moved again to a motel in Fort Smith, Arkansas, where Bonnie took a turn for the worst and became feverish and delirious. In Arkansas, they were pretty much unknown, so Clyde finally called a doctor who tended her wounds. But she wasn't improving, and a frantic Clyde feared the worst and barely left her side. Believing she was going to die, he drove back to Dallas to inform Bonnie's sister of her dire situation. He couldn't tell her mother, as he feared the law were watching her house. So her sister, Billie Parker Mace, along with her small two children, made the journey back to Fort Smith with Clyde to be with Bonnie. Billie stayed with Bonnie and somehow nursed her back to health, but it proved expensive, meaning Buck and W.D. still had to rob local businesses. On June the 23rd, 1933, they robbed a grocery store, but as they made their getaway, Buck crashed the car. The pair were bruised and scraped, but otherwise unhurt. And when Town Marshal Henry D. Humphrey and Deputy Sheriff Red Solliers arrived on the scene, Buck and W.D. fired their guns at them. Humphrey was shot 3 times and later died from his injuries. And when Sheriff Red ran for cover, they stole his car. He managed to get a shot in and blew the top of W.D.'s 2 fingers off, but despite the injury, the pair managed to get away. When Clyde heard of the incident, he knew they would have to move on, and he gathered all of them up, including Billie, and over 2 trips, they were miles away in Oklahoma. Bonnie slowly recovered, although her leg would never be the same again, and her mobility was restricted. By now the pursuit of the gang had stepped up, and their ordeal was getting national attention. A lot of evidence had been found in the car wreck in Wellington, Texas. And so to keep Billie out of trouble, it was decided she would get a train and go back home. On July the 7th, 1933, Clyde and Buck raided a National Guard armory in Oklahoma and stocked up on guns and ammunition, before relocating to Missouri, where they rented 2 tourist cabins near Platte City. But the strangers soon attracted attention. Their attire and spending habits were unusual, and it wasn't long before the local sheriff, Holt Coffey, was convinced he had the Barrow Gang in town. And knowing how dangerous they were, he requested help from nearby Kansas City, who reluctantly loaned him a bulletproof car and other support. On the evening of July the 19th, 1933, the sheriff managed to pull together around 12 officers, and they made their move on the cabins. The sheriff knocked on the door of Blanche and Buck's cabin first, and Blanche answered and shouted to Buck the code word she needed to get dressed first. Clyde heard the commotion from next door and immediately started shooting at the bulletproof car parked outside. It proved useless, as the driver was shot in both legs. The officer retaliated with a flurry of bullets. Bonnie and W.D. managed to grab a few things and get to the garage where the car was parked. Clyde opened the garage door for Buck and Blanche to get in, but Buck was shot in the head. However, they managed to bundle him into the car and drive off at speed, dodging a hail of bullets. They didn't escape unscathed. Blanche had glass shards in her eye from the shattered back windows. Bonnie's burn wound had split open, and Buck was in a very bad way. Finally, the battered and bloodied gang found refuge in a wooden area near Dexter, Iowa. But it wasn't long before they caught the eye of the local deputy, who notified the county sheriff. And on July the 22nd, 1933, the lawmen made their move. Clyde immediately started shooting, and the officers retaliated. W.D. was hit 2 times, but the gang managed to get in the car and make their escape. Clyde drove to a dead end and they were trapped. Clyde had also been shot in the shoulder and was bleeding. Despite their injuries, all 5 of them got out of the car and ran into the woods whilst the lawman shot at them. Bonnie took 2 bullets to the stomach. W.D. was hit again but bravely picked up Bonnie and carried her, but Buck was down. He'd been shot in the back. He urged the others to leave him and go on without him, but they wouldn't hear of it, and Clyde grabbed him and Blanche and dragged them through the woods. But Buck could go no further, and Blanche refused to leave him, so they hid behind a fallen tree. The lawmen were still in pursuit, so Bonnie, Clyde, and W.D. pushed on towards the river. All the while, Clyde was shooting back at the police, but with his injured shoulder, his aim was off, and he had been hit again in the cheek. Their only chance of escape was to cross the river, so with Bonnie on W.D.'s back, the trio crossed the river and reached the other side. They then stole another car from a nearby farm, and the gang sped away to safety. The lawmen found Blanche and Buck, and after taking another shot to the shoulder, Buck was close to death. Blanche was arrested, and Buck was taken to hospital. The glass in her eye was removed, but eventually she lost the sight in one eye. Buck was in far worse shape, and his brain tissue was now poking out of his skull from the shot he took to the head. Despite his horrific injuries, lawmen still tried to question him. They also sent for his family, and Cumi made the long journey to see her dying son, accompanied by Emma Parker and Al C. Buck managed to confess to the killing of Henry Humphrey, as well as a string of robberies, but he was a dying man, and his wounds had become so infected that the odour from them meant it was hard for anyone to stay near him for any length of time. But he stayed alive long enough for his mother to say her goodbyes. On July the 29th, 1933, 10 days after being shot in the back, Marvin Ivan Buck Barrow died with his mother at his side. He was just 34 years old. He had been involved in 3 murders, 4 shootouts, and 2 kidnappings, as well as countless robberies. His wife Blanche pleaded guilty to assault with intent to kill during the Missouri shootout, and she was sentenced to 10 years in jail. Buck was buried in West Dallas on July the 31st, 1933, and the Barrow family knew it was only a matter of time before Clyde joined him. It has always been rumored that Clyde attended his brother's funeral dressed as an old lady, a claim the police have always denied. Bonnie, Clyde, and W.D. had quietly slipped out of the limelight to recover from their numerous injuries. But it wasn't long before they replenished their weapons cache by robbing the National Guard Armory in Illinois. Not long after they headed to Mississippi, where W.D. took off again and headed to Texas, where he found work as a cotton picker. This time Clyde didn't try and stop him. It was just him and Bonnie, and they were now the most wanted people in Texas. Despite this, they still managed to spend time with their family and often took on various wigs and disguises, with Clyde frequently dressing up as a woman to go unrecognized in his hometown. But their lifestyle was taking its toll, and despite them both still only being in their early 20s, they looked much older. Remarkably, the Dallas police, for the most part, did not actively look for Bonnie and Clyde. There are 2 theories about this. Firstly, they were paid off by Clyde. Or secondly, they were scared of taking on Clyde, fearing, with his expert shot, they would be the ones who came off worse. Towards the end of 1933, tragedy struck for Bonnie's family when her sister, Billy's 2 children, died within days of each other, most likely from typhoid or flu. In November 1933, W.D. was tracked down to Houston, and after he was arrested, he spilt the beans on his time with the Barrow gang. And to save his own neck, he claimed he was forced to go on the road by Clyde and never actually killed anyone. If a second weapon was used, it was Bonnie who was the shooter. Years later he admitted this was a lie, although he did claim that Bonnie was the shot loader. Not long after W.D.'s arrest, Bonnie and Clyde had a near miss with the police when they were in Dallas for Cumi's 59th birthday. Police got wind of it, and a shootout ensued, but as usual, Bonnie and Clyde evaded capture. Although, the police did find their abandoned, bullet-ridden car near Fort Worth, and as it had blood in it, they believed that one of them had been shot. In fact, they both were, although not seriously this time, and within a week, they were back in Dallas. But the ambush so close to his family had enraged Clyde, and he wanted revenge. With the help of Jimmy Cullins, a former Eastham inmate, he plotted to break out his old partner, Raymond Hamilton. Mullins had served time with Raymond, and while they were inside together, Raymond had agreed to pay Mullins $2,000 if he joined up with Clyde on his release and broke him out. Clyde didn't trust Mullins, but reluctantly agreed to help out. And on January the 13th, 1934, Clyde, Bonnie, Mullins, and Raymond's brother, Floyd, drove to Eastham Farm Prison and hid 2 pistols and ammunition in the grounds. Floyd then visited his brother and told him of the plan. 3 days later, the plan was executed. Raymond and fellow inmate Joe Palmer used the hidden guns to shoot two guards and made their escape along with two other inmates, along a ditch where a car with Clyde, Bonnie and Mullins was waiting for them. Another man also escaped into the woods but was quickly recaptured. The breakout made headline news with wild reports that Bonnie and Clyde had marched into the prison and broke Raymond out. The breakout raised their profile even higher and also increased the bounty on Clyde's head, which now stood at $1,000. The newly formed gang almost immediately started robbing banks, but within a week, two of the escapees went off on their own, and one of them was recaptured and gave details of the rest of the gang to the police. Sadly, news also filtered through that one of the guards, Major Croson, had died of his injuries. Raymond also now had his girlfriend in tow, a woman called Mary O'Dare, who Bonnie didn't trust, and eventually they all had a big fallout when Clyde discovered Raymond was siphoning off proceeds from their robberies to give to O'Dare. The two couples parted ways, and several weeks later, Raymond was recaptured and gave an interview to a newspaper in which he blamed the money issue on Bonnie, not Mary. Bonnie and Clyde were so infuriated by the report that they sent a letter to Raymond in prison, but it was intercepted by the newspapers and published. This was one of the only known times the pair retaliated to the many untruths reported about them. The hunt for the fugitives was stepped up, and the Texas prison director, Lee Simmons, was determined to bring Bonnie and Clyde's reign of terror to an end. So, he enlisted the help of Frank Hamer, a noted Texas Ranger who had a legendary reputation as a gunslinger, and he was ordered to shoot to kill. Hamer travelled thousands of miles to try and trace Bonnie and Clyde's movements, contacting law enforcement in all the states he visited, and despite his order, Hamer wanted to take Bonnie and Clyde alive, but he had not figured just how elusive the couple were. By the spring of 1934, just one of the Eastham Farm escapees was still with the couple. He was 21-year-old Harry Methvin. The couple were still making regular, incognito visits to the family in Dallas, and on April 1, 1934, they waited with Methvin on a hill near Grapevine for family members to come and meet them. Bonnie had a white rabbit with her that she had acquired as a gift for her mother. But at around 3:30 p.m., two State Highway Patrol officers on motorcycles approached the car, and allegedly, Clyde said to Methvin, "Let's take him." Then either Methvin or Clyde pointed their guns at the two officers. Edward B. Wheeler and H.D. Murphy were both gunned down in an unprovoked attack. Eyewitness accounts claimed Bonnie was one of the shooters, a claim the family have always denied. It's also been said that Clyde didn't mean take them as in kill them, but rather abduct them, as they had done many times before. But Methvin thought he meant shoot them. After the brutal murders, law enforcement were ever more determined to track the fugitives down, although at the time they were unaware Methvin was also travelling with them. Less than a week later, the trio re-emerged in northeast Oklahoma. They were parked up on the side of a highway sleeping in their car, and were reported to the police by a passing motorist. Two officers went to investigate. One of them, Cal Campbell, was shot in the chest and killed instantly. The other one, Police Chief Percy Boyd, was knocked to the ground and forced into the car. After a terrifying drive, they later released him hundreds of miles away near Fort Scott, and the chief had quite a story to tell. Boyd was able to identify Methvin, and the police were very slowly starting to piece things together. But the trio were still making risky visits to the family in Dallas, and Bonnie had even managed to give the rabbit to her mother, Emma. However, they had been spending much of their time with Methvin's family in Louisiana, and they became close to them and trusted them. But Boyd's ID of Methvin meant the police soon started to sniff around the Methvin family and discovered they had recently moved and had shown signs of unusual and mysterious wealth. But if Clyde had thought that he'd bought their silence, he was wrong, as it wasn't long before the local sheriff, Henderson Jordan, was given a message that the family wanted to talk to him. In exchange for a deal for their own son, Henry, Ivan and A.V. Methvin offered to give the sheriff information about Bonnie and Clyde's whereabouts if Henry's jail term was lifted and no further action was taken against him since his escape. They also claimed they were scared for their life and what Bonnie and Clyde might do to them and their son. But before they gave out any information, they wanted the deal in writing. Law enforcement was only willing to scrap Henry's original prison sentence, and they wouldn't make any promises about any crimes Henry committed after he escaped. Reluctantly, the family agreed to the deal and said they would help the lawmen set Bonnie and Clyde up. In early May 1934, Bonnie and Clyde met up with family in Dallas again. Bonnie gave her mother Emma some photographs and a poem titled The Story of Bonnie and Clyde. She also made her mother promise that she would not say anything horrible about Clyde after they were dead, and asked her mother to bring her body home to rest for one last night after her death. Clyde also visited his father. He wanted him to sign some papers relating to a farm purchase in Louisiana, but they couldn't find a pen, and the documents were never signed or seen again. During the same visit, ironically, he said Melvin's parents were the finest couple he ever saw, and he had moved them to the new farm. After the visit, Bonnie and Clyde went back to the Methvins in Louisiana and stayed the night at their house. Lawmen were informed of the visit, and the Methvin mapped out Bonnie and Clyde's next move. The police in other states were getting ever more desperate to catch the fugitives, and one by one started to take members of Bonnie and Clyde's family in for questioning. Of course, they didn't tell them anything. Then, in an odd move, Bonnie's sister, Billy, and Floyd Hamilton were charged with the Grapevine murders. A witness, William Sheffier, identified them as the killers from mugshots, and was certain a woman had turned over one of the officers and fired into him point blank. In reality, they had nothing to do with the murders. By now, the Methvin family had let their son Henry in on the plan to keep him out of prison. Henry said he wanted more than anything to get away from Clyde Barrow and promised to help with their plan. On May the 22nd, 1934, Henry joined Bonnie and Clyde, and the three drove to Shreveport. Henry intended to separate from the couple, knowing they would head back to his parents' house to look for him. So when they stopped off for food, Henry stole a car and slipped away. As predicted, Bonnie and Clyde made their way back to Henry's parents' house, but when they knocked on the door, he wasn't there, and Ivan told them to come back around at 9:15 the next morning. The law was informed, and the trap was set, and over the next few hours, a posse gathered that included Frank Hamer. In the small hours of May the 23rd, 1934, the group picked a spot along the single-track road that led to the Methvin's house. Everything was in place. They were armed with an arsenal of weapons, including shotguns, automatic rifles, and pistols. Ivan also joined them in his truck. He was to park on the side of the road with his truck jacked up and act as a decoy to slow Clyde down. But as he waited nervously at the side of the road, he lost his nerve and asked to call the whole thing off. But he was in too deep now, and they sent him back to his truck. As predicted, Bonnie and Clyde stopped off for breakfast and headed to the Methvin's farm. As they approached and saw Ivan's stranded truck, they slowed down and stopped to help. Bonnie still had a sandwich in her hand, but the plan was nearly scuppered when a logging truck appeared in the opposite direction, and Clyde rolled forward to make room for it. The move triggered the gun of Deputy Prentice Oakley, who was hiding in the bushes. The shot hit Clyde in the front of his left ear, likely killing him instantly. Bonnie let out a piercing scream. Then the rest of the lawmen opened fire, sending dozens of bullets into the car and the bodies of the outlaws. For several minutes, there was a continuous roar as the bullets rained down on the couple. As Clyde's lifeless body ceased to function, he gave them one last fright when his foot slipped off the brake pedal and the car rolled into a ditch. Thinking this was a sign he was still alive, more shots were fired at the vehicle, this time on Bonnie's side. But there was no doubt they were both dead by this point. Clyde's partially blown off head hung out the window of the car. Bonnie was still sat in her seat with her head between her legs. The car interior was splattered in blood and body tissue. At the scene, Ted Hinton pulled out a 16mm movie camera and started filming the carnage. Despite claims in the aftermath of the shooting that the officers had yelled halt at the couple, giving them a chance to surrender, the reality was Oakley fired the first shot without warning, giving them no chance. In the bullet-ridden car, there were numerous weapons, including Clyde's favourite BARS, and at least 1,000 rounds of ammunition, as well as suitcases full of clothes, makeup, magazines, canned food, a saxophone, and sheet music, as well as 15 license plates. Once locals heard that Bonnie and Clyde had been shot, they converged on the site like vultures and grabbed any kind of souvenir they could get their hands on. This included bits of glass, bullets, snippets of clothing, and even locks of hair. It was 2 hours before a tow truck arrived and took away the car complete with its bloody occupants. It was followed by over 100 cars and trucks eager to get a glimpse of the carnage. The couple had been covered with a blanket, but that didn't stop locals trying to catch a glimpse of their dead bodies as they were driven through the town of Gibbsland, Louisiana, on their way to the coroner's office in Arcadia. When they finally reached their destination, their corpses were stretchered away through Conger's furniture store, which doubles as a funeral home and out of view of the crowds. Once inside, the coroner examined the bodies and noted more than 2 dozen bullet holes in each one. This made embalming a challenge, and ironically, Dillard Darby, who the pair had kidnapped in 1933, and who Bonnie asked to embalm her, was actually called in to assist. The coroner also recorded the couple's many wounds, both new and old, as well as tattoos and the jewellery they wore. Bonnie still wore her wedding ring from her marriage to Roy Thornton, as well as 2 other diamond rings, a watch, and a cross necklace around her neck. Outside the furniture shop, a crowd was gathering, eager to view the bodies of the outlaws. And soon they stampeded through the furniture shop, causing hundreds of pounds worth of damage. It was reported that the coroner sprayed embalming fluid at them to drive them back. Whilst Bonnie and Clyde's bodies were being tended to, the 6 men involved in their hijack were talking to the press, all giving different stories, and it soon leaked out that the Medvins had played a pivotal role in the pair's downfall. And true to their word, the authorities gave Henry a conditional pardon from his prison sentence, and he was never tried for the murders of the 2 patrolmen near Grapevine. In the aftermath of their deaths, the legend of Bonnie and Clyde took root, and nearly 100 years later, we are still talking about it. Bonnie had always said she wanted to be buried beside Clyde. She even wrote it in her poem, The Story of Bonnie and Clyde. But Emma, her mother, denied this request, blaming Clyde for her daughter's demise. Also, the flood of publicity and curiosity seekers meant she could not grant her daughter's wish of spending one final night at the family home. Now in separate funeral homes, crowds started to gather, wanting to get a glimpse of the bodies. People even started to pull up flowers and throw them into the air. Eventually, Clyde's father agreed to let well-wishers view his son's body, and hundreds of people rushed through the doors of Sparkholt's Brand Funeral Home in Dallas to see Clyde dressed in a light dark suit. But as soon as Henry heard someone say that they were glad he was dead, he shut the doors on them, causing further commotion. A similar scene was playing out across town at the McCamie Campbell Funeral Home, where Bonnie was laid out in a silky blue dress. Up to 20,000 people scrambled to view her body. In total, it was estimated at least 50,000 people came to view both bodies. Clyde Chestnut Barrow, aged 25, was buried in a short private funeral, with just close friends and family in attendance. During the service, a small aeroplane flew over and dropped a wreath. It was a gift from Benny Binion, who ran a local gambling operation. The next day, 23-year-old Bonnie Parker was buried. The funeral was attended by over 150 people, and as Bonnie's coffin was lowered into her grave, her mother Emma fainted. Clyde, who shared a gravestone with his brother Buck, had the simple epitaph, "Gone but not forgotten." Bonnie, on the other hand, had a far more poignant one that reminded her family of how she used to be before she met Clyde. It read, "As the flowers are all made sweeter by the sunshine and the dew, so this old world is made brighter by the lives of folk like you." In the aftermath of the funeral, Bonnie's sister Billy was freed from jail, as was Floyd Hamilton, after ballistics showed the guns found in Bonnie and Clyde's car were responsible for the deaths of the 2 highway patrolmen near Grapevine. Barely a week after their deaths, a film about their lives was being advertised at the Majestic Theatre. The footage Ted Hinton caught of the ambush was to be featured. All this just intensified the grief the families were feeling, and both families fought and succeeded in getting the movie stopped. But the interest didn't stop there, and the fame was recorded and embellished in countless newspapers, books, and magazines. And in particular, one of their associates over the years were cashing in with untrue and overdramatized accounts of life on the run with Bonnie and Clyde. One of the most enduring myths about Bonnie was that she smoked cigars, something that was not true but had been played on by the press and public. Some wild claims also suggested that Bonnie and Clyde were homosexuals, which in the 1930s was considered abnormal and deviant behavior, and that Bonnie was a prostitute. Even Bonnie's mother and Clyde's sister told their story in a book called Fugitives, the story of Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. The book told a lot of untruths and was probably the way the family wanted to portray the outlaws and romanticize the story, often making excuses for some very serious crimes. But the many publications did nothing to help the family and acquaintances of Bonnie and Clyde, because in January 1935, 23 people, including Bonnie's mother Emma and Clyde's mother Cumi, as well as other members of the family, were arrested and charged with harbouring or assisting criminals, one of the largest indictments of its kind in the US. It was noted that some police officers had died as a direct result of the accused helping the couple evade the law. 20 of the accused were found guilty, including Emma and Cumi, who were sentenced to 30 days in jail, and Bonnie's sister Billy and Buck's wife Blanche, who each got a year and a day. Even Clyde's youngest sister Marie, who was only 16 at the time, was sentenced to an hour in prison. For Raymond Hamilton and Joe Palmer, the punishment was much more severe. They were both sentenced to death for the murder of Major Crowson during the Eastham prison breakout. They were both executed by electric chair on May the 10th, 1935. It was the fate that surely would have been betrothed to both Bonnie and Clyde if they had been caught alive, an outcome they desperately wanted to avoid at all costs. Amongst the many legends surrounding the couple, the most enduring is about missing cash that was allegedly in the car at the time of the shootout. It's claimed that Clyde had been paid $6,000 to break out inmates from Fort Worth jail, but the money was never recovered, and at the time, authorities said that only $500 was retrieved from the death car. Years later, Clyde's oldest sister, Artie, claimed Clyde buried the money near a stretch of road in rural Dallas, and meant to draw a map to give to his father, but had to retreat before he finished it. The cash has never been recovered, and is possibly still out there, buried in a suitcase on the side of a road in Dallas. In the years that followed the death of Bonnie and Clyde, many films and book adaptations were produced, most of them grossly inaccurate and often sympathetic towards the couple, portraying them as a good couple turned bad by an unfair justice system. Others boosted up the part Bonnie played in the saga, making her America's deadliest sweetheart, who used her sex appeal to charm Clyde into a violent life of crime. None of these adaptations were huge successes, and were so wildly inaccurate the families chose to ignore them. However, in 1967, the movie simply titled Bonnie and Clyde was shown for the first time. It starred already established film star Warren Beatty as Clyde and relatively unknown actress Faye Dunaway as Bonnie, with Gene Hackman as Buck and Gene Wilder as the Undertaker, who eventually embalmed the couple. The movie was shot in Texas, and the ending was particularly gruesome and bloody for that time. The scripts took liberties with the facts, and some of it was played for laughs to add romantic value, but audiences and critics alike loved it. The renewed attention on the legend of Bonnie and Clyde, however, opened wounds for some of the victims of their crimes, and they wanted nothing to do with it. Many were unhappy with the inaccuracies in the characters and how they were portrayed. However, despite this, some of them cashed in on the revived story. And for a time, some of the victims' families and Bonnie and Clyde's remaining relatives became minor celebrities, giving interviews and telling their stories. The movie made $70 million, the equivalent of $500 million today. It won 2 Oscars and made the stars and Bonnie and Clyde household names around the world, and they became far more famous than they could have ever imagined in real life. The film also increased the value of the many mementos that were still around that were stolen from the crime scenes. And in 1973, the bullet-ridden car they died in was sold for $175,000 to a Nevada casino, who also paid $85,000 for the bullet-ridden blood-stained shirt Clyde was wearing when he was killed. Guns and trinkets have sold for 5- and 6-figure sums. And in Gibson, Louisiana, there are 2 Bonnie and Clyde museums. An ambush reenactment is also staged every year. Also, many songs and poems have continued to feature the plight of the couple. It kind of brings to mind that crime does pay, although not necessarily for the participants, but rather for the public, who have an ongoing fascination with criminals and murderers. In this case, the lines have been blurred, and Bonnie and Clyde are often portrayed as a romantic couple, deeply in love, who supported each other as wronged outcasts, trying to dodge an unjust and corrupt law. But in reality, however much it has been dressed up, these two were nothing more than cold-blooded killers who routinely killed, often defenseless and unarmed people, leading Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow to go down in history as the most notorious outlaw couple to have ever lived.